All right, a little bit of context here. This is Zach Childs, guitar tech to the stars, host of the popular, can't speak. We're not going to redo it, though. It's one take. Popular YouTube channel, Ask Zach. And he does a lot of things. He's a guitar player himself. He works for True Tone, doing sales. Busy guy. But I met Zach actually coming into the Brad Paisley interview that we did a couple weeks ago. I was walking in with my team to set everything up, and he was walking out with a guitar that I think he was bringing to Glazers or something like that. We started talking briefly. It was a brief conversation. We went our separate ways. I went in to do the Brad interview. Zach went to do whatever he was going to do. And that was kind of it. After the interview with Brad, we got reconnected, and I asked Zach to come onto the podcast because I'm a big fan of the show, which you gotta watch, Ask Zach on YouTube, and he's got a podcast as well. And I'm just a fan of the show because it's, if you're a guitar player, it's super informative, very historical. It's got tips, just really good, really fun. So I asked him to come onto the show, and I said, Zach, I'd love to do an interview with you as well. And he said yes. So here we go. You got the whole interview right here. It starts off in the middle. We start recording in the middle of a conversation about New York guitar players. I'm a New York guitar player, and we're talking about Jim Campolongo and some other people. So it's the conversation starts kind of in the middle of that conversation, talking about New York guitar players, but you'll get it. You'll put it together, okay? It's going to be fine. Here we go.
Moving here in the early 90s was just culture shock.
Yeah,
you know,
right,
coming
right.
From South Texas, and then it was just, you know, like the food, the weather, the allergies, you know, it was like everything was just kind of bizarre.
Yeah.
Yeah, so...
That's the there's Jim Campolongo in New York, although I don't think he's in New York anymore. I think he actually moved.
I think he went back out to California.
But yeah. I used to take lessons from him in high school.
Oh my goodness.
Because he was like the only guy. It was funny because I had a local teacher who actually really turned me on to kind of like Telecaster picking. He was my high school teacher.
Okay.
And he was my music teacher, basically, high school music theory teacher. And he was supposed to be teaching me classical, like Baroque, Bach chorale type stuff.
Yeah.
And one day he came in with a black Esquire custom shop. And are we recording?
I am recording.
Yeah, we'll get the audio and then we'll get the video and we'll figure it out. But
he said one more little thing I would turn, but just to make sure he's totally leveled up.
He brought in a black Esquire and he started playing Van Halen licks on it, but it sounded like a distorted twangy telly. And I said, that's the coolest sound ever.
Yeah.
And then he started showing me country licks. And then he taught me a lot of early kind of like chicken picking stuff that I learned. And then I tracked down Jim Campolongo because I was like, there has to be someone in New York who can do this.
Yeah.
And I just emailed Jim, took the train out to his apartment in deep, deep, deep Brooklyn. And he really taught me a lot of stuff. I mean, I used to go there. I would try to go there once a month. And he did this thing that's so smart is I would bring my phone. And the second we'd start, he'd say, just record the entire lesson. So that if anything I play, if you want to go back to it, it's on your phone.
Yeah.
And I've got hours of his lessons on my phone, which I still go back and reference like different things that he showed me and taught me. But and he was a top loader guy.
he is, yeah, and such a fantastic player that has such a unique take on the instrument. And
such a unique voice, yeah.
Yeah, and it's just like as soon as you hear him, he just has a freedom, and he's not, you know, he's not holding anything back. He's doing his thing, and he just has such a freedom on the instrument that it's, and he's so used to expressing himself in that way, that it's hard for, like, I've seen other players that I like play with him. And, you know, especially if somebody is more of a sideman kind of thing and they're used to having to kind of reel things in and being reserved. And then you've got Jim who just does whatever he feels at the moment.
Yeah.
He's not thinking about I'm backing up a major, you know, singer songwriter or something like that. He just, I mean, just the wackiness and the, you know, and he's really the guy that really took the Roy Buchanan thing and went beyond with it.
Really
using every aspect of the guitar, you know, the behind the nut bends, the harmonics and just everything else banging on the guitar. And, you know, the fact that he's just got a Princeton and
that's it. That's all he takes to a gig.
Yeah.
And he gets such a woody tone out of it, too.
Yeah.
His tone, I think, is very unique compared to a lot of other Tele players.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's him or what it is, but he gets a great tone out of it.
Yeah. Your hands are a big deal.
Huge.
And that's one of the things that, through the years, I've played a bunch of famous guitars. I've seen other people play.
And you sound like you.
Yeah.
Isn't that exactly. annoying? Don't you wish that there was a guitar you could get that would?
Yes.
I was watching the interview you did with Duke Levine.
Yeah.
And I used to take lessons with Duke Levine, too, because I went to school in Boston. Wow. And Duke, to me, is like probably the greatest Tele player that isn't always listed amongst the best Tele players. Like, I think a lot of people still don't know about him. But he's unbelievable. Right. The people who know.
Yeah.
But he said to me in one of the first lessons I ever took from him, he said, if I was you, I would go listen to Luxury Liner, the song. He said the album, but he was pointing out the song. He said, learn everything happening in this song. Learn the rhythm part. Learn the solo. And I did. And it was so hard to do because the playing in there is monstrous. But I know you love this album because you did a whole episode of your podcast.
Yes.
Ask Zach about this album. Did you have a similar experience? Did you discover this album and then try to learn every lick on it and try to pull everything out of it?
Absolutely. This is in the pre-internet days, and I had gotten into Albert Lee via Eric Clapton. So Eric Clapton had a live album called Just One Night, and Albert's kind of playing rhythm and he's, singing harmony. And then there's a couple tunes where he kind of gets let go, where he really, like on Cocaine, he gets to do a cool solo, and he did a solo tune where he sang called Setting Me Up. It's an old Dire Straits tune off the first Dire Straits album. And I just really liked his playing. And I used to go buy Guitar Player magazines, the old ones. They used to have them at used bookstores.
Yeah.
And I would buy stacks at a time because they were like 25 cents each. So I'd make money doing yard work or playing a gig or whatever. And I would go into this used bookstore. It was called Half Price Books. It was in Corpus Christi, Texas. And I would go in there with $20 and I'd buy a couple vinyl albums, maybe a cassette or two, and a stack of old Guitar Player magazines. And anyway, in one of them from the early 80s, there was an interview with Albert Lee, and they also did like an essential listening for Albert. And
the Clapton album was so one of them.
The Clapton was, but also the Emmylou Harris and the album Luxury Liner. And so I was on this trip with my family, and we came back through San Antonio, Texas. We stopped at a record shop, and I found that album. And, it was on vinyl. And again, this is like in the 80s, maybe it's 1990, something like that. And I bought it. And then I'm driving home with my dad, and I can't listen to it, because we're in a car.
Yeah.
And I'm just staring at it. And you pull out the inner sleeve, and there's a picture of Albert, and he's got a black guard. And there's like James Burton, and there's, these other.
Isn't it funny to see those photos of Albert with an actual telly? Like, it's almost goofy.
It is
to look back on,
because it's been so long since he's played a Tele, and he was so identified, and people still call him Mr. Telecaster.
Yeah,
but I mean, he's been playing that Music Man guitar.
His tone's not really even a Tele tone anymore. It's a Strat tone, it's its own thing, really.
It is. It's its own thing, and to be fair, you have to think about being a commercial guitar player. And think about, playing on hits and making an impact in the 70s. And then you're trying to stay current, because that's always kind of the deal with being a sideman.
Right.
And so in what happens in the 80s, well, Strats become really cool. And that becomes the soundtrack of everything. That's what you hear on beer commercials and on every album that you hear. And so he was just wanting to stay current. And for us, it's like, why did you abandon, the sound that kind of
the telly,
the telly that kind of brought you to the table? But James Burton did the same thing.
Yeah.
James Burton, I remember I bought a James Burton signature Telecaster, when they came out in 90 or 91 or something like that. And that's what I moved to town with.
Yeah.
And so, Brad Paisley and I were, that's what we met in college here at Belmont, and I showed him the guitar, and so I had a Paisley guitar before he did.
Yeah. Wait, the original James Byrne ones was a Paisley, basically?
Some of them.
It wasn't the flame look.
Well,
the...
it was before that. Before that, they had solid color. There was solid red. There was solid white. Then they had a black with a gold paisley pattern on top of it. And so that's what I had. So it was basically black, and then it had a gold paisley design.
But I love the story because he basically told you, he said, you got to get a real telly.
Exactly.
He said, this is not a real telly.
This is not a real telly.
The audacity.
Exactly. And so, and you know, I knew a lot about guitars and I knew about tellies, but I didn't realize that that's where a lot of the sound of a Telecaster was coming from the bridge. And the fact that you had the pickup suspended from it and that you had the copper, you know, kind of steel base plate, and you had all these things kind of working together to create a certain sound. But I know we went all around in circles there, but yes, the Luxury Liner album was hugely impactful. And I learned, like, you know, most of the tunes off there, and it was a really big deal. And I still love it to this day.
Would you go back and would you listen to that vinyl, and would you just keep setting, like, keep redropping the needle to try to get the licks on it?
Yeah.
Like that's how you would do it. I know that sounds crazy to think back.
That was the only way to do it.
Basically.
That was the only way of doing
and
it.
And were you obsessed about figuring out every lick perfectly, or would you kind of be like, that's the style of air, that's the spirit of what he's doing, that's good enough? Or were you trying to get the rhythm part and, like, every part of it perfect?
I would, for me, it was all, because I was gigging a lot. And this was in the early 90s. And so I would never learn anything exactly note for note.
Yeah.
What I would do is that I would learn whatever the guitar intro was, you've got to play that right, because that's the signature. So you've got to play that right. And then whatever the outro is, you know, whatever, you know, there's like these key licks in the song.
That's
like,
what you would get.
Yeah, you would get that. And then the solo needs to be in that mode and similar, but it wouldn't have to be note for note.
Right.
So with Luxury Liner, I'm making sure that I know basically the intro lick, the digga digga digga, and then
and then
the kind of the rhythm pattern, and then you know, of course the song modulates a bunch and stuff
like
that.
It's a weird song.
Yeah.
It's so cool. Okay, wait. So I love the story though, going back to it. So Brad tells you that he basically says, this is a crap telly. He goes, this, you need a real telly. He's so arrogant, and he takes you. You guys go to a local music store. Do you go Con Music? Is that where you went?
We went to Con Music. Yeah.
And basically, you end up buying a Takai telly, right?
Right.
Why not a Fender? Was that one more affordable at the time?
It was more affordable, and he liked the Takais. So he had had a, he still has it, but I mean, I think it's like, you know, it's on a wall back. It's like his childhood home in West Virginia. It's still over there, like on the wall. His parents still have his childhood home. I don't think they don't go up there very often, but it's like hanging on the wall somewhere. But anyway, he had a Tokai Strat. I guess it would have been called a Gold Star Sound or something like that? Because the telly was called a Breezy Sound.
Yeah.
Yeah, they had the worst names. But yeah, he really liked that guitar. And he knew, you know, neither one of us had much money. You know, we did, you know, because our parents were, you know, we were at Belmont University, which was, it's not as expensive as it is now, but still it was pretty darn expensive.
Yeah, right.
And
right.
So there, you know, and we were scraping together money to get like a Papa John's pizza or something like that every once in a while. We were scraping together quarters and stuff like that. But anyway, he was a fan of that, and we liked Cotton Music because it was across the street from Pancake Pantry. And we went to Pancake Pantry a lot.
It was a two-for-one. You could get the pancakes and pop into the guitar store. Yeah,
It was a two-for-one. And so, and we were talking the other day about just how we used to eat back then. Because, you know, we're both, you know, in our 50s now. And so thinking about back then, when we would eat a 6-egg omelet along with 3 pancakes and then like a, you know, like a soft drink or a chocolate milk or whatever
it was.
You know, it was like not drinking coffee. We were drinking some kind of sugary beverage, a bunch of pancakes and like ham and cheese omelets and stuff like that. But yeah, so we would go to Pancake Pantry a lot, and then we would go across street to Cotton. And so they had a bunch of these Tokai Breezy Sounds, and they were, they were great guitars, and they were less expensive than a a Fender.
Do you still have that one? Because you did a video about your guitar collection.
Yeah.
And that one I noticed wasn't in it.
Mm-mm. So it's kind of a sad story. and I'll tell it, you know, kind of quickly. Well, the guitar was pink, okay? And this was in the early 90s. And
was it like a shell pink or like what was the...
It was like Pepto-Bismol like,
yeah, yeah,
pink.
Pink.
With
yeah,
like
yeah.
a little bit of you know, sparkle in it.
Yeah.
Not like a big metal flake, but it had like real, real fine metal flake. And so I had just gotten it. You know, Brad and I had gone through all these guitars. They had like five, maybe it was more like 10. They had 10 of these Tokai Breezy sounds at Cotton Music. We go through all of them. The best sounding one is this one that happens to be pink. I think I traded a PV transistorized amplifier and a couple hundred bucks for it. So I get the guitar, and then we had spring break, and I was flying down to Texas to see my family. Well, there was this girl that I was interested in that was a singer, and she was there. I saw her at the airport, and I had the Tokai in a gig bag with me. And, you know, I was trying to impress her, and so I pulled the guitar out. And the first thing she said when I pulled that guitar out, she said, "Oh, it's a girl's guitar."
No. And that bothered you?
It did, because I was... You know, so insecure.
But I think pink guitars are so cool now. Oh, they're so cool, right?
They are. And so I ended up, just a year later, I got another similar guitar that was kind of pinkish, but also had binding and was but to kind of, I think I had to kind of recover from that. Because what I did was, after she said, "Oh, it's a girl's guitar," was as soon as I got home, I sanded all the finish off.
Oh my God.
Yes, I disassembled the guitar. My father was a Ford and Nissan dealer. And so I sanded all the finish off myself at the house. Then I took it down to my dad's dealership. I went to the body shop and I asked the guys there to paint it because I had to go masculine.
Yeah.
So there was this kind of dark maroon color with metal flake that they were doing Mustangs in at the time in the late 80s, early 90s.
That's what you did. Huh?
And I did that. But here was the thing. And people talk about how paint doesn't change the way something sounds, but it really does. Because the finish that was on it, the pink finish, it was a polyurethane type finish, but it was thin and hard. It was not soft. Well, the finish that those guys in the body shop put on there was a car finish. And a car finish, well, guess what? It's designed to be somewhat elastic.
Yeah.
So that if someone gets in a fender bender or something like that, well, it crumples or whatever, but you don't see paint shatter and go everywhere.
Right. And it totally changed that guitar.
It totally. The guitar turned into a complete turd.
Oh, my God.
And so I sold it to a friend of mine that still owns it to this day. And the first thing he did was he sanded all the finish off.
Restarted.
And all of a sudden the guitar was a good guitar again.
Yeah.
And so that was just, you know, one of our many, you know, kind of crazy adventures,
yeah.
you know, of college and messing around with guitars. Because, I mean, that's, you know, we both had like a couple of Telecasters and we were always changing out pickups and we didn't have a ton of money. At times we would swap necks on guitars to just see, where's the tone coming from?
Yeah.
And you found that the neck was pretty important.
Isn't that such a good thing? Because I feel like I've never really played around like that. So it's like, to me, it's like, I always know. Is that my phone? If it is, yeah, I think it is. Let me silence it. To me, like, I've never, like, I know intuitively that, like, oh, a maple neck is going to sound different than a rosewood neck. Yeah. But I've never really had a telly and put a rosewood neck and a maple neck on the same telly and, like, really experience the difference.
And it has more to do with just each neck has its own kind of thing going on.
Yeah.
And it's not as much having to do with maple versus rosewood. There are woods that I just don't like. Like, I don't like
ebony, right?
Ebony.
Yeah.
Yeah, I hate ebony.
Me too. Every time I play an ebony neck, it just isn't doing it for me.
It's too bright. It's too hard sounding.
Yeah.
But to me, like, rosewood board is not warmer sounding than a maple. I think what it is that a rosewood board is very similar to a maple cap because it's a stiffer neck. And then it comes down to which do you like the feel of, because, you know, rosewood and maple feels different because of the finish on it.
Right.
So, you know, like, I would much rather have a maple cap neck than a rosewood board neck, unless it's one of those really old rosewood necks that is so worn in and it doesn't feel like you have drag on it.
Right.
Have you ever seen the rosewood boards that you can see the grain and it's big and open, and it feels like when you try to bend on it that it's just like, it feels like you've got like
almost splinters.
Yes. It's like, what's going on with this?
Yeah.
This is
although
terrible.
My telly's got a great rosewood neck that it feels so fine.
Yeah.
And I like it better than the tellies I have with maple caps. So it's,
and I get that completely. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
And that, those are the ones you want. I mean, that's what you want out of a rosewood board.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm so envious. So you got a 57 Esquire, but a couple years ago during the pandemic, right?
Mm-hmm.
How did you convince your wife that this was a worthy investment? And also, to me, the telly, if I understand, it's like, it's not the original finish. I think you had it refinished, mm-hmm. and you've had some other things done to it.
Yeah.
So did those things bother you, or was it such a great guitar that those things aren't as important?
Yeah. This is all going to make sense and add up.
Yeah.
Always wanted, everyone wants, it'd be cool to have a 50s Telecaster Esquire. And it's just, they've always...
I want to know how to get one. Secretly, yeah. I just want to know how I can get my hands on one.
So there is a semi-famous collector down in the Houston area named Charlie Daughtry. And he had let my friend J.D. Simo borrow this, I think it was a 55 or 56 Tele. And JD let me borrow it, and I took it to just to rehearsal. I wasn't going to take the this, because even then it was probably a $10,000 to $15,000 guitar back then, and it was just, I loved the shape of the neck, I loved the soft V thing going on with it, and I really fell in love with the guitar. And I told JD, I said, "There's no way in hell I could ever afford a guitar like this." And he said, "Actually," he said, "if you found one that was a body refin and one that's an Esquire, that would be, you could probably find one of those." So I started looking like crazy for one of those. And the other thing that you have to know is that you are not going to find a good guitar here in Nashville.
Because they get picked too quickly?
They get picked too quickly. So it's like...
And there's a premium when they sell them that Carter and Groon and everything.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so if you have a good telly, then you already have, five of your friends have already told you, if you ever decide to sell this,
I have a telly
that
Guthrie Trapp has said he would buy for me.
Exactly.
When I'm ready to sell it.
See?
And I go, how is that possible, Guthrie? Like, you're out of your mind.
Yeah.
But there are people that would buy my telly. I could sell it in a second.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And that's the way it works. So if, because really great tellies are, they don't happen all the time.
It's funny how they really don't. It's hard to find good guitars.
Because a lot of tellies are boat anchors, or they just don't have much life to them, or they have really super skinny necks, or there's something that's wrong with them.
Right.
Or
right.
They just, everything didn't come into an alignment.
Right.
So, so that's the thing. I had to kind of widen my search and decide that I was going to travel, a couple hundred miles if need be to find... a telly. And so I already had my sights where it was like, okay, I want a mid-50s V-neck Esquire that's had a body, that the body's refin. Been refinned.
Yeah.
Especially one where it's had a bad refin where it's going to hurt the value the most.
Yeah. Because you knew that you would basically scrap the finish. And
exactly.
Yeah.
And I have plenty of friends that I can call upon to do the work. So I found... So Dan Strain of Danocaster Guitars, he's a good friend, and he was in on this also, even to the point of like, because I had a couple of Danocasters at that point, and he said, look, if you find the guitar, don't feel bad about selling your Danocasters to help fund this. And I said, are you sure about that? And he said, yes. And he said, I'll make you another one down the road. Dan and I are really good friends.
Yeah.
And we've been good friends for a long time. So it was... I kind of felt funny with him, supporting me that, but he's like, hey, this is, this is kind of a
rite of passage.
Yeah. And it's a kind of a lifetime guitar.
Yeah.
So it's not like, I'm not one of those guys. And I love Joe Bonamassa and those other or Brad or these other guys that own like tons of vintage guitars.
Oh my God. Brad's got like a wall of Blackguards.
Exactly. So I'm not that guy. And so this is kind of a lifetime guitar, and Dan understood that. And so he said, okay, we're, you, you, because he knew I could flip them really quick and generate some money. So the guitar pops up on Reverb. It's in Tuscaloosa, Alabama. It's been painted rattlecan blue. I mean, it's not the end of the world, but I mean, it doesn't look good. The original pick guard warped, and they had put some ugly cream single ply on there. The frets were completely worn down. I mean, even from the pictures, I mean, you could tell the frets were pretty worn.
Yeah.
I mean, it was going to need a refret. And so I asked, you asked, you know, how did I work it out with my wife? My wife said, you're a big boy. She said, if you can sell the stuff to cover it,
go ahead.
I don't care. Go ahead. Do it.
Yeah.
Yeah. My wife, Amy, is a wonderful person. And she's always kind of had a very, you know, matter of fact attitude. It's like, you know, hey, if you can pay for it, you know, as long as you're not taking food out of, you know, the family's
and the kids'
mouth,
college fund. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
So it's like, you know, if you can sell stuff to pay for this and she even was kind of like in a reasonable period of time, you know, as long as, you know, but so I went, so I saw it on Reverb. They were asking a lot of money for it. I talked to them over the phone. This is during the pandemic. I call him on the phone while I'm driving down there. It's Halloween day.
You've sold the guitars already at this point not yet?
Not yet.
Yeah.
So, but I had already decided, cause it was like late Friday when the listing came up. Saturday morning, like first thing in the morning, I'm leaving because, you know, it's a couple hours down to Tuscaloosa. So I want to be there when they open.
Yeah. Right.
And while I'm going down there, I'm calling up and asking to talk to the owner and trying to get some price negotiation even before I get down there, because it's like they were asking too much, especially when, you know, I arrive and there's even more undisclosed issues. And that's not to pick on them or anything, but there were just aspects that they weren't aware of. So, because it's like, it wasn't a hardcore vintage shop, because that's another thing. That's one of the things you're paying for when you...
In Nashville is the authentication of everything,
right.
Yeah.
So there's a higher level of authentication that's involved with buying from Carter or Groon, because they're looking at everything. They're putting everything, you know, everything's going through a fine tooth comb. So there was stuff that they didn't identify. So I show up, they agreed to come down on the price. The guitar, the frets are completely worn out. I plug it in. The guitar sounds terrible. I mean, it has no low end. And immediately I know that the pickup, the one pickup on the guitar it's pretty much dead. So what happened is that if you looked at it, the pole pieces, the low E pole piece was completely covered in rust, which is a telltale sign of the fact that, and that's why you're supposed to, that's why Leo Fender designed the cover.
Right. You did a whole episode.
Yeah, I did a whole episode
about this. Yeah,
yes.
Yeah.
And so, like, Leo knew this was going to happen, so he put a cover over it. But of course, it made it to where you couldn't
palm mute or pick by the bridge,
right.
Or do a million things.
You can't do a million fun things. So it's just kind of a cost of doing business. If you're going to play a telly, you're probably going to have, and if you sweat and play outdoor shows, at some point you're probably going to have your bridge pickup rewound.
Right.
You know, and it's not a big deal. You know, it's like you send it in to somebody, Ron Ellis or whoever else, Seymour Duncan, Lindy Fralin, tons of people can do rewinds, and they take the windings off. They look at the pattern, like they kind of unwind it, you know, slowly, so they can see what the winding pattern was. They clean off, you know, all the pull pieces. They dip it in lacquer. They rewind it. They repot it. They put the twine on it. The whole nine yards. So, anyway, the pickup was dead. It sounded terrible, but the neck felt so good. The neck just felt perfect. It was like, this is the best feeling neck I've ever felt in my life. And so they wouldn't go down anymore on the price, even though the pickup was dead. And I was just kind of having a hard time. And, you know, and it's during the pandemic, so, you know, you're wearing a mask, and I'm down in Tuscaloosa, Alabama. It's like, what am I doing? And it just seemed like the dumbest thing in the world. And it was so much, I'd never spent that much money on a guitar in my life. And finally, I just felt like, okay, I know all the people I need to know to fix
to
this
bring
guitar.
This to life.
I know Ron Ellis, you know, I know he can rewind the pickup. I know that the Nick down at Glazer's shop can refret this thing and do anything to the neck that needs to be done. I know Dan Strain can do, you know, he can do a refin on this thing, and we can put another pick guard or what have you on it. And so I just said, okay, I'll take it. And so it felt so weird, you know, when I handed him my credit card.
Wait, you hadn't sold the DanoCasters yet?
No, I hadn't sold them yet.
So this, now the clock's ticking, or your wife is gonna freak out.
No, she was cool about it, because it was kind of like a reasonable period of time. So I buy the guitar, and this is one of the stupidest things that I remember, is it was like, I hadn't had any lunch because, again, it was during the pandemic and you're driving down, there's no place to stop. But I found like a Popeyes of all things that was open. So on the way home, I stop at this Popeyes and I'm eating like their spicy chicken sandwich, which of course at that point tasted amazing because I hadn't had anything to eat all day. And I'm driving home, you know, with the 57 Esquire that's, you know, got a lot of problems and it needs a lot of help. And so, you know, got it home. It was Halloween, so I had to get home in time for all the, you know, Halloween festivities.
Yeah, right.
So,
right.
You know, for my kids and stuff. And so the guitar just stayed. In fact, I just left it in the trunk.
Oh, my God.
And, you know.
Who's going to take it? Yeah. No one even knows it's
there. No one knows it's there. It's in, you know, it's in my neighborhood. So, yeah, so I'm just doing that. And then so Sunday morning, I pull it out and start messing with it. And it's just like, again, you know, now I'm playing it through my amp and everything. And it's like, it sounds terrible. It has no low end at all, but the neck feels amazing. So I take it down to Dan's, you know, place, and we disassemble the guitar. We take the pickup out. I take the pickup, you know, we put it in a box. I contact Ron Ellis. He says, you know, he'll rewind it. And we start taking the blue rattle can finish off. And Dan makes me do the sanding on it. And so it was just one of these great moments as you're taking the finish off. You know, Dan says before we even like get very far, he says, I bet it's a one piece body. I bet it's a one piece body. And the whole guitar is 6.5 pounds.
Oh my God.
Which is a really light. That's a golden weight
for
Telecasters. To me, the perfect weight is in between 6.5 and 7.5 pounds. That's perfect.
Right.
Even up to 8 is fine, but that's really the best, you know, weight range. So there we are taking the blue, you know, paint off, and yeah, it's a one piece ash body. And, you know, Dan redid the, you know, cause I was going to do it black, but when it came out as a one piece body and we saw signs of where it had definitely been blonde before, which was the standard finish. It was that kind of white blonde. We, you know, Dan redid it in that. You know, he took the neck, you know, down to Nick Glazer's, and he refretted it. And, you know, Ron Ellis rewound the bridge pickup. I just threw a Ron Ellis neck pickup in there and wired it up. And the thing just sounded so good.
Yeah.
It's my favorite Tele of all time. I have yet to play one that's better to me.
Yeah.
So, and that's it's a nice feeling. It's like, there's no one's Tele out there that I'm like, oh, I would rather have that one.
Yeah. Right. Right.
So it's, and you know, because it was a body refin and all the stuff that was wrong with it. Yeah. It was reasonable. What's reasonable, but I mean, it was under $10,000.
Yeah.
So
people tell me, cause I talked to a lot of people about this, cause I want to get into this game, even to dip my toes into it. And my biggest worry is that when I actually have the money to afford this stuff, that this stuff is going to continue to get even more and more expensive, and I'll be priced out of it then.
Yes.
But my people give me the advice, which is get into an instrument that's super straight, because then you'll have an easy time selling it or flipping it.
Right.
But it seems like you got this basically, although you could probably flip this too if you wanted to, because now you've made a great guitar out of it, but you got this basically for life. Like, you were like, I'm gonna get this guitar and this is gonna be a guitar that I'm gonna have forever, basically.
Yeah,
you weren't worried about flipping it basically or anything like that.
No, I've never been into flipping guitars. I would be a terrible, you know, guitar dealer, you know, just because it's like, to me, the only ones I want to buy are the ones that are inspiring, and then it's like, I don't want to get rid of it then.
Yeah.
So I don't know that I wouldn't be the best, you know, guitar shop. So, but yeah. And I'm very obsessed with Telecasters. And so it was kind of like, this was one. So I've played a ton of Blackguards, and Blackguards are great. And it's like, you know, Brad has a bunch of them, Red Volcard, you know, I've played Vince's 53, I've played a bunch of different Tellies, and they're all really great and have their own thing. But to me, it's like, this is my guitar. Yeah. And so it's just kind of, yeah.
You're inspiring me to like want to go down this journey. Like yeah. Now, here are the tips. Yeah. We're going to wrap it up. Here are the tips. Yeah. Go outside of Nashville. Mm-hmm. You got to search far and wide.
Yes.
And don't be afraid if this thing looks like a pile of mess, if it's a refin, if the pickguard's not working, don't be afraid. There could be a great guitar underneath there.
Yeah.
How were you so confident though? Like, this is what always confuses me. Like, when I'm outside of Carter or Green, you just show up at a shop and you see a body that's spray painted blue. How do you know that is what it is? Are you looking for the pencil markings in the heel, or how would you know that? How are you confident that you weren't getting something just like a parts caster, basically?
Right. So there are, there are like dowel, there are pin router marks on the body, and those were there that you could see them through the paint. You could see it on there. So you could tell that it was a real, you know, 50s Telecaster body. And, but there wasn't any pencil marks or anything on the body. On the neck, it was January of 57. So, and it was very legit in the neck. Those 50s necks, the thing that's really wonderful about them is they were really old wood when those guitars were made in the 50s. That was really old maple. And so the wood almost seems fossilized. Those necks are really stiff. And so it's problematic if the neck is warped or twisted, because sometimes it's really hard to get them to untwist. So finding a good 50s Telecaster that has a straight neck on it, which this one had a straight neck,
yeah,
it's like it's not really going to, I mean, unless something really bizarre happens, it's probably going to stay straight and it's going to be a good one.
Right.
So that's kind of, and yeah, it was kind of like the neck felt so good and the body was light and it felt like, okay, everything else is fixable.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm inspired by this story. I'm going to be on Reverb this afternoon, yeah, seeing what I can find. And then maybe I, too, will be driving hours outside of town.
Yeah.
I want to ask you this. I've heard this story about the Paisley Drive, and I want to be sure that I have this right. Were you teching for Brad Paisley at the time?
No.
Oh, this wasn't you? I've got this wrong.
No, it wasn't me.
When Brian Wampler basically ambushed him.
Okay, so part of it I was.
Yeah.
And part of it I wasn't, because this happened... So this is kind of a funny thing. We were setting up in Indiana, and we were in a theater, and yeah, I'm usually a pretty easygoing guy, but that morning I was like not in a good mood.
Yeah.
And you know, it just happened to, you know, it was just kind of like, I was just kind of feeling a little surly, and we're setting up, and all of a sudden there's this guy that shows up, and he doesn't have a backstage pass. And he's just there backstage. And it was Brian Wampler. But I was about to get security and have him removed because he was looking at stuff. He was going up and looking at the guitars and such. And he hadn't even said anything to me yet. And then all of a sudden, I just remember, it's like, treat people the way you want to be treated. You know, just kind of feel him out, see what he's like, see if he's, you know, rude or whatever. And so I introduced myself, and he, you know, that's how I found out it was Brian Wampler. And he was very nice. And he knew the people at the venue well enough that they would just kind of let him in.
Yeah.
And he would come around. And so he didn't tell me anything about making pedals really or much about that. And I think at the end of the show, he gave Brad, I don't know if I didn't see it, but because there's different, you know, kind of, you know, because I didn't see, but evidently he threw this pedal. But I saw the pedal when Brad came off stage. He hands me this.
So this was you? Or
yes.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah.
So he hands me this Boss OD3 pedal that has what looks like a big, gigantic Gibson toggle switch coming out of the side of it. It's big, gnarly, and stupid looking. And I was like, what is this? This looks terrible. And, you know, I got it, and Brad's like, go check it out. And so I plugged it in and it didn't sound good. And so I contacted Brian back and I said, hey, thanks. You know, it wasn't, you know, it wasn't really what we were, you know.
Yeah. Why even call him? Why not just write the guy off as a lunatic and just say whatever and move on down the road? You actually called him?
Yeah. I was just trying to be nice. So then not long after that, you know, I didn't think anything else about it. Because not long after that, my tenure was over. I had gotten burned out of being out on the road.
Yeah, right.
And I was just like, I'm done. And so then Chad Weaver came in after me. And so that's when evidently Chad really made the Paisley Drive happen. I mean, he was, you know, a big part of that. You know, he was really the liaison between, you know, Brad and Wampler, and he really made that happen. And so, yeah, so I think credit needs to be given to Chad for making, but I was around for that initial kind of, you know, funny thing, but then I wasn't around for
what's the deal with, so now Brad's got this blue Paisley. I don't know what we can say about, but I've played the guitar.
Yeah.
It's been announced. The guitar is weird because I did the interview and I ran into you when I was walking in to do the interview.
Yeah.
And I played the guitar. And everyone's been coming up to me saying, how good is that guitar? Is that guitar really great? And I said, look, I can't explain it. A Tele is just a Tele. Like, and on one hand, a Tele is just a Tele. But on the other hand, that's a really great guitar. That one's really special. What is the deal with that guitar?
Well, I can say that guitar is really special.
Yeah.
It's, and I've played hundreds, maybe thousands of Telecasters. And the thing that was amazing about that guitar was, you know, it kind of got put together, as it were, and it's just as soon, nothing was done to it. It got, and there was no setup work. It was just bolted together. This was, you know, old parts that were all of a sudden, you know, we put it together and hand it to him, and he plays it, and it's like, what is going on? It sounded so good. It sounded like old Pink, but better.
Yeah.
Because to me, that was always, in the past, that was probably my favorite of his guitars. And it was not because it was the greatest guitar of all time, but it just had, it had his voice. You know, because that's the sound, you know, that's the sound on so many of his albums. I mean, and that's the sound on, you know, Mud on the Tires.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
And, you know, and that's the Fishing Song. That's all these tunes. That guitar has a certain sound. And it's like you plug that guitar into an Aquapus or a DD2 and you get it into a, you know, an old AC30 and a Dr. Z amp. And it's like, and it has that thing. And that guitar immediately had that thing, but more.
Yeah.
And it was just kind of crazy because I know, you know, because I watched the interview, of course, and you did a great job.
Oh, I so appreciate it.
And it was just, you could, it's just like, even if you play Old Pink or La Brea next to it, it's like, what does this guitar have? It's like it just has more.
Yeah.
It just has more low end and it has more pop. It has more assertiveness. It has, you know, it has a lot of really great things going on. And every once in a while you just have these things that, you know, yeah, what's, it's like, why is it doing that?
And that guitar is actually from 57.
67.
Right? Or, I'm sorry, 67.
Right.
Where his original Pink Paisley is from 68.
Correct.
So the 60s. So what, do you have a sense, because to me it's always weird that in 67, it's kind of like, it's sort of the beginning of a downturn for Fender quality, because it's CBS. At that point, CBS owns Fender, right?
Well, yeah.
And they're still figuring out, they're still putting paper on these things and trying to make cool guitars. But Brad goes, it's a bad idea. He said in that interview, he goes, this was a bad business idea.
Yeah. So the company changed hands in January of 65. So really everything
after that. Years. But
66 is where you start seeing, you know, a different logo. You start seeing the transition logo. 67 is a big transition year. That's where you lose the Klussen machine heads. You start seeing the F tuners. You lose the transition logo. You get the big black CBS logo because they were more concerned about it being seen, visible on television.
Versus the spaghetti logo, which is so clean.
Right. Or even the gold transition logo. Yes. It's a cool look. And you go from blackface to silverface with the drip edge.
Right.
And so, Yeah, the 67 is a really big transition year. And yeah, Fender was really, there was any time a company is purchased, there's a lot of pressure for it to be more profitable. And everyone's trying to squeeze out more money out of everything, and you've got to sell more. And this was also at a time when Gibsons were really becoming pretty cool because of the Guitar Heroes, because you really didn't have Hendrix as much yet, and you kind of had Jeff Beck and Clapton and Mike Bloomfield. A lot of guys were starting to play bursts and 335s and things like that. And so Fender was really feeling like they needed to try different things, and that's where you get things like the Coronados, things that look kind of like 335s, but with, you know, Strat-looking kind of headstocks.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
And they were also having trouble. They didn't want to pay the money for lighter ash, and so they start trying to hollow them out some, and that's where you get what's called the smuggler's guitars, where they would drill out. They would route out underneath the pick guard, right. And then they found out that didn't make enough of a difference. So then you get the thin line that comes out in 68. Yeah. And then the Paisley, thing, which was, again, it was kind of late because, 66, 67, when they're, cause fads change quickly. And so the whole flower power thing and hippie thing was kind of like, free love. It was already kind of moving on. Yeah, even by 68. So it's kind of like they're kind of, it was kind of a little late. And that's why the guitar, really, I think also because of how much more it was. I think y'all talked about the fact that it was like,
it was more money and it looked disgusting, basically. Yeah,
it was like, because a regular Telecaster was 225 and then it was like, 275 for the Paisley. And it's like the only difference is like they've put this contact paper on the front and back and they've put poly, on top of that, and they've bursted the sides and they decided to charge, a lot more for that, for the aesthetic. So yeah, it's an interesting time. And frankly, I think that's another really golden era of guitar. So it doesn't really surprise me that Blue Paisley is so great, because the maple cap neck guitars, 66, 67, 68, those are some of the most consistently good guitars, and the rosewood board ones too. But I remember even back when I was teching for Brad in the early 2000s, and I was talking about getting a vintage guitar. And this is back when, a Blackguard was probably $10,000 or something like that. And it probably was reasonable, but, we were doing a session with Red Volkart. I think we were doing Spaghetti Western Swing or something like that.
From On the Tires.
Mud on the Tires.
It's a great, fun track.
And we're hanging out after they record it. We went to a Mexican restaurant. We're sitting there in Bellevue. And I was, lamenting to Red how much vintage, Telecasters are. And he said, well, you ought to just get you a, I'm not going to try to imitate Red Volkart. That was terrible. But he said, you need to get a 66 through 68, maple cap, neck Tele. He said, those are consistently good. They still have, a lot of them still have a nitro finish, and they still have like the cloth covered wires instead of the plastic insulated wires. And, they're just, they're really, you can find really good ones. And there's just something about that era of guitar that I really like. And it is a real transition time where things are changing over.
Yeah.
But there's just a lot of good guitars from that era, and it's something that I've always liked those guitars. They have a real assertiveness to them.
Yes, they really do. How many of those Blue Paisleys do you think even exist?
I mean, this is just a thought, but the thought is that, Fender probably mocked up some when they were trying to decide what color. So, I don't know. Maybe there's two or three or something like that.
Yeah, yeah, that's kind of like what you would think, right?
Yeah, so not a lot of them. Because, they're going to get some bodies. They're going to put some of that, paper on there. They're going to finish it out into a whole guitar, and then they're going to put it in front of the marketing and sales department.
Yeah.
And then they're going to be like,
What do we think? For all you know, there were more that were destroyed, or they said, "Ah, that's not good," and then they tore the paint, the paper off, and finished them in something else or whatever.
It's amazing. A lot of companies, you know, started destroying prototypes and things like that.
Yeah.
You know, and unless it was just like a really trusted friend of the company or an employee that really wanted it, a lot of times those things started being just, you know, destroyed. So I remember talking to a guy that was, you know, working with Leo Fender at G&L, and that Leo didn't want any prototypes to go out there because he hated when those prototypes would go out there and they'd be
worth a lot of money. You told the story on an episode where who was the guitar player who wanted to keep a prototype because he loved it?
Yeah.
Who was that, Jorgensen?
No, it was a friend of Jorgensen's named Jeff Ross.
Jeff Ross wanted to keep a prototype and he wouldn't let him.
Yeah, he said, no, we're gonna run it through the saw.
Yeah, right.
So, yeah. So I think that, you know, maybe some things, you know, drifted out. Maybe some things were destroyed. But, yeah, a lot of times, you know, you're trying to control your image and everything else. And so sometimes you don't want those things to go out there. And so sometimes you throw things into the chipper.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Okay. We've got a couple minutes left here. It was funny because after the Brad interview, we were playing through his Harmony 415 that he has. And he was telling me, he goes, "You know what that is?" And I was like, "No." He was like, that's Ken Fisher's personal amp. And he was saying how Ken loved that circuit. So a lot of people have been asking in the comments of that video, what is that amp? So it was a Harmony 415.
Yes.
So I then went out and I bought one on Reverb, which sounds incredible.
Yeah.
They're so cool. They kind of are what they are. They're like clean Class A, clean machines, but it sounds unreal. And then I was watching an episode that you did on the PV-130.
Yeah.
Right? And I was like, shoot, should I get one of those too? I'm into these amps now. But here's the greater point. What are a couple pieces of gear, and you could say the PV, but what are a couple pieces of gear that you think are undervalued or that are super affordable that people should check out and are really cool? And you could say the PV again. You could plug that.
Yeah.
But are there any others right now, any pedals or anything that you think people overlook and they should pay attention to?
Well, it all depends on, you know, what kind of volume level you're playing at and such. But yeah, the PV stuff is, especially the 80s PV stuff with the silver, you know, kind of pieces on the sides of the cab.
Yeah.
Those, the Special 130, the Bandit 65, the Backstage 35, those are all really good amps. They're very giggable. They don't need any, you know, the worst you have to do is you know, blow out, you know, the cobwebs and get some deoxit and clean the jacks and the pots.
Yeah.
And those are just, those are inexpensive. You're going to pay, you know, $300 or less for those things. Now the downside is that they're heavy, you know, but they have good speakers on them and they've got good transformers and everything. So they're really good. That the Harmony 415 is really, Even though people have been clued into them because there's been articles about them.
Yeah, right.
And like in Vintage Guitar Magazine and different things like that. So people are kind of clued into them.
But I've also been talking to a lot of like really educated guitar people because they were like, "What were you playing in that video? It sounded great." And I was like, "Oh, the Harmony 415. And like really like smart people in the space were like, "I've never even heard of that." Like I think a lot of people still don't know about it.
No, they don't. And so, you know, they just haven't taken the time to look that up. But those are really cool amps. They're seriously great. And I contemplated, you know, picking one up, but I just felt like I was already too heavy with that. I think the Ampeg stuff is still highly underrated, you know, especially if you go to like the early Reverber Rockets and things like that, where they've got like 6V6 output tubes and then they've got octal preamp tubes. I mean, those might run you $1,000 to $1,500, but those are really cool amps that are really toneful. I don't know that, you know, it's like trying to think about, you know, bargains or sleepers and stuff like that. I always think about the Lab Series amps. So those are kind of stage amps. They're not for, you know, playing a club really. Yep. They're really loud, but I used to play through the L9 Lab Series amp, which was at least 100 watts, and it had a 15-inch Electro-Voice speaker in there.
Yep.
And so it was the size of a Super Reverb, and it had a great compressor built in. It had really good reverb. It had great EQ controls where you could really dial in the mid-range appropriately. and those are really great amps that you can still find for like $400. And if playing on big stages, and that's what B.B. King used, the 212 version, for like 20 years.
Yeah.
I mean, he just kept using them and using them. I mean, it was like up until he died, that was still his preferred amp, was he'd rather have that than a twin reverb. And that speaks well to just the tonefulness and the good, and it's really good old transistorized technology. As far as other sleepers, I mean, the Vox AC-10, the old ones, they're kind of still a bit of a bargain compared to like an AC-15. And I really like the AC-10 Twin, which of course was the 210 version, which, you know, you're still going to probably pay $3,000 for one, maybe $2,500.
Yeah, right,
but
right.
But they're not as much as what an AC-15 would be. And it's, and the only, you know, they padded the inputs on the AC-10 to make it to where it was a greater difference in volume between it and the AC-15. So if you take off the pads, it's pretty much the same amp.
Yeah.
And it has real tremolo as opposed to the Vibrovox circuit,
right.
which I don't like, which it's too kind of wacky sounding. I just want straight sounding, you know, tremolo. So,
right.
Yeah, that.
Those are good answers.
Yeah. So
you know what I used to play in high school, I played a pedal that I swore by, and it was an Open Road by Visual Sound.
Yes.
Which, of course, became True Tone.
Yeah.
And I lent that pedal to a friend of mine throughout college and everything.
Yeah.
And a couple of years ago, he emailed me, and he was like, I still got this pedal. You want it back? I'll ship it to you.
Yeah.
I said, yeah, I'll take it back. And I think it still sounds great. I think that's an underrated overdrive.
It really is. I mean, and I've worked with Visual. I still work with True Tone, and I worked with them back when the Open Road was developed. And I'll just tell you, it was a dead nuts copy of a Nobles ODR1.
Yeah.
So back in 2002, when we were recording the Mud on the Tires record, we would do the tracking at the Castle, which is a recording studio, you know, here in Nashville.
Yeah.
And Brad would play acoustic and sing through the tunes, and the rest of the band would be playing. And then we would go to Tom Bukovac's house, which at the time he lived in Bellevue, and there was a studio that was attached to his home that had a really great board and mic pre's, and it just had two little isolation booths, which were fine, because that's where he would do all his guitar overdubs and also his vocals. And so we spent, and it was cheap. So that was, you know, so the thing was, you know, use the expensive studio to do the tracking
of
drums and bass and B3 and all that stuff. And then we could go to the cheap studio where Brad could spend weeks doing guitar overdubs, getting tones and things like that. So sometimes I would show up in the morning and Brad would say, you know what, I'm feeling like singing, you know, so we're going to sing a couple of songs this morning so you can just hang out. Well, it wasn't worth me driving home, you know, because it meant they were probably going to sing for 2 hours or something like that. So if Tom would just let me come into his house and, you know, and make coffee or whatever, and I could hang out, and I wouldn't like go all through the house or anything like that. But sometimes he was there and I would just, you know, chat with him. And Tom told me about, you know, the Nobles pedal. And he said, you know, this is a great, you know, this is my favorite overdrive. He called it the secret weapon. That's, you know, that was one of the things he said, even, you know, way back then. And at the time, you know, the old green ones, they were $30 to $50.
Yeah, right.
And so I went out and bought one, and I'd had it for years. And so fast forward, you know, a number of years, and I'm working for Visual Sound, now True Tone, and we're trying to come up with an idea for another overdrive pedal. And I said, you know, this is a really great circuit, and I think we could do a great take on it that's made better. Because to me, the problem with the Nobles pedal was it just wasn't really made real well. It just wasn't real sturdy.
Right.
And so, you know, we had a nice die cast housing and a good foot switch on it. And so that's what we did. And so it was a, you know, a Dead Nuts Nobles ODR1, yeah, you know, copy.
And you can get them on Reverb. I think they're like, you can get them for like $120 on Reverb.
Yeah.
They're like fairly priced, but yeah, I think it sounds killer. I love the way that pedal sounds.
Yeah. I love it too. It's, you know, it's a great pedal.
Yeah.
And yeah, I was, you know, it was funny because it was like the demand for them was so much that it's like, I couldn't get one for a while. So it's like, I'm working for the company and yeah, it was like the, you know,
you couldn't even get one. It was your idea.
Ideas are kind of a funny thing. Cause it's one thing to have the idea. It's another thing to implement it.
Right.
So I just, you know, so it was kind of like, yeah, it's an idea to copy something, but yeah, it's a whole nother thing to do it. But yes, but it was just kind of, it was a funny thing of like, oh, I had to, you know, wait, you know, they're, because they're shipping them out to dealers and trying to fill orders, and so I had to wait until the second, you know, run was made at the factory before I got one.
Keep going.
And then I had my own open road pedal.
Oh, I love it.
Yeah.
Zach, thanks so much for taking the time.
Yeah.
By the way, if you're watching this at home and we look a little sweaty, the air conditioning is broken in the studio and we powered through it anyway. So thanks so much for doing that in the heat. We got through it. And I so appreciate it. And by the way, you have to go listen to Zach's podcast and his YouTube if you haven't. Ask Zach everything we've talked about. If you've made it this far into the episode, it's only because you're a massive guitar nerd. So if that's you, go to the YouTube channel, Ask Zach. He throws all the episodes up as podcasts as well. You can listen to the audio. True Tone, they make amazing power supplies. They have limited pedals as well. Jekyll and Hyde, they still make a couple others. Yeah. Anything else we should plug that we haven't plugged?
Yeah, I appreciate you plugging that. So,
absolutely.
Yeah.
Thanks so much for taking the time. And we covered a lot of ground here.
Yeah. Thank you so much for having me, Zach.
Absolutely. We'll see you next time.
All right.
There we go. Woo! We got through it. The heat didn't get me too bad.